All right, so good evening. It's good to see everybody. Sound okay?
Yeah.
Yep, all right. I'm going to talk a little bit tonight about service and generosity. And then a number of the people who have been in this year-long course, How Can I Help, are here. Maybe they'll have some comments after I'm done, and then we can go from there. So, generosity in the many lists of Buddhist qualities of mind always shows up as being on the short list of important ones. And you probably all heard the phrase paramis, and depending on which school of Buddhism, there's 8 or 10 or 12 paramis, and these are qualities of mind that are considered essential to a mature practice and to becoming awakened. Okay, and so generosity is one of the ones that is always on those lists. But the point I want to make about this is that it's not just generosity. If it's I'm occasionally generous, I'm haphazardly generous, I'm generous when I remember to be generous, it doesn't make it onto the list as a parami. What's on the list of paramis is the perfection of generosity, or the perfection of these other qualities of mind. So it is a quality of mind that has been taken on as a specific practice, and that becomes an embodiment, not something that is inconsistent or random. Does that work? Huge distinction. And then, to provide context on this, another thing that may be helpful to hear is that we always hear about at the time of the historical Buddha, there was the Buddha, there was the historical Sangha, and then there was the lay community. And, you know, and there were these three elements. And that's both correct and incorrect, because there are a whole series of suttas on practicing as a lay person, a lay man or a lay woman. But at the time when the Buddha was alive, there was a subset of householders that were called noble disciples or noble disciples. And these are lay people now. These were not monks or nuns. And they were people who had basically devoted themselves to the Dharma. You know, not that they were interested in using a lot of it, and but they had actually devoted themselves to the Dharma. And being in this category, you were considered to have, you know, traditionally, there are four stages of awakening, and the first one is called stream entry, meaning that you have entered into the stream of the Dharma, and the theory is once you do that, you know, there's no turning back, you know. So if you were classified as a normal a noble discipline, you were considered to have entered stream entry, and there's marks of that, of what that looks like. So it's one thing to pick up some of these suttas and lead them as, well, like they're a layman like we are. You know, you're practicing at a community level, and you may or may not have a certain level of commitment, as opposed to you're a layperson and you've actually devoted yourself to the Dharma, to the teachings, and are trying to embody them basically all the time, you know. Other than like the 80 or 90% of the time when we forget. But another for me, huge distinction, okay, I think it's one thing to think about generosity, and it's another thing to think about perfecting generosity in your life. It's one thing to think of yourself as a layperson, basically an undisciplined layperson, and to think of yourself as a noble, disciplined layperson who has basically upped the ante on your practice and what you think these teachings mean in terms of creating a life and pointing towards a particular kind of life. Because, and I gave a talk about this a number of months ago, but the Buddha said that if you followed a whole series of rules, which, and I've always found it fascinating that there's even rules for managing your money that the Buddha outlined. You know, it's like, you know, I don't know why I think that's so funny, but it's kind of like I have it in my mind, well, the Buddha's first discourse on money management. You know, the Buddha's, but there are such things. And he said that if you follow these generally, that as a layman or laywoman, that you were both seeking and it was possible to see the good visible in the present life, and that you could have a form of temporal well-being and happiness that was completely achievable as a layperson in this lifetime. So this second element that I'm talking about being a noble discipline, and frankly, most of the things that we talk about on Thursday nights, because, you know, we're looking at suttas or discourses that, generally speaking, were not being used to educate lay audiences. That's what we're doing in the West. That's one of the very, very unique things about Western Dharma. Okay? So, the Buddha said these other things were shooting for something much bigger than just kind of a temporal sense of well-being and satisfaction. You know, like, well, gee, I'm comfortable, and my family's comfortable, and I'm doing some good, and what have you. He said what the end game of the practice was to find a peace and satisfaction that was lasting and was not dependent on external circumstances. So those two elements, that it's lasting and not dependent on external circumstances, you know, takes this practice and moves it into a very small set of practices that are available to people as a spiritual practice. Because, you know, just think of the idea that you could actually have a deep and lasting satisfaction and peace in your life that was not dependent on external circumstances. So just think for a moment of all the things that are bothering you right now, or have been in the last 6 months or the last year. And how many of them are external circumstances? The most people, when they sit down and do that, find that the majority of focus, you know, because attention is everything, is on things that are exterior. We may be having an interior reaction to them. But what's generating the discomfort is we're reacting to something that's outside of us. And so the Buddha said that what he was looking for and what the teachings were about were not what was out there. It's what was in here. And to find a peace that wasn't dependent on how much we were making or weren't making, if we were sick or weren't sick, if members of our family were sick or not sick. It's, you know, you start thinking of it that way, it's quite a standard. And it's both a high bar and, you know, even with a little imagination, you can see what an extraordinary form of satisfaction and peace it could be if you were able to actually be present in the world with all of the stuff that's going down all the time around us in our life and other people's lives, and you were able to be in the middle of that with a sense of equanimity and a sense of compassion and kindness and care, and not be buffeted around by it. It's pretty exciting prospect. So the Buddha said if we could even start getting towards this kind of generosity, I mean, like we even start thinking and trying to have a generosity that is not just purely visible in the present moment, but that is beginning to reshape our internal structure and reshape what our default is in response to conditions, you know, that generosity would help play three different roles in moving us forward on the path of practice. I find these really interesting, partially because of the way that he's creating a juxtaposition between what you might do with this and the rest of society. Okay, so the first one, you know, the Buddha used the term dwell a lot. You know, like you dwell in quietness or peace or happiness or what have you. And it's, you know, just being present, not needing to do anything. Okay, so he said the first one is that it would allow you to dwell in balance amongst a general population that is not in balance. And of course, he's talking about our emotional and psychological life, you know. So, you know, I think that the Buddha's view of society in general was, you know, a group of people who had pretty chaotic emotional and psychological minds, you know, that they weren't in control of their psychological and emotional life, and they weren't in control of their thoughts. They may think they are. They're clearly not in control of their suffering, you know. And so that's the first one, that you could actually dwell in balance in yourself, even though the population around you is not in balance. It reminds me of that poem by Rudyard Kipling. Yeah, you know, where it's like, and the refrain is, "You're a better man than I am, Ganga Din." You know, and everyone about us is losing their head, and you can remain calm. You're a better man than I am, Ganga Din. And I went back and looked at that poem recently, and because the idea of that I thought was so cool, you know, like I'd use it in a talk, but I adapted somehow. Yeah. And much to my surprise, he only uses the term, "You were a better man than I am, Ganga Din," one time in the whole poem. I thought it was a refrain, you know, like he'd say, and then it refrained. Not true. So you should be suspicious of.
Huh? Was it the last one?
Almost the end. Almost the end. Yeah. So the second thing that the Buddha said that generosity would help kind of push us down. He says, you could dwell without affliction, meaning psychological and emotional affliction, amongst a population. He actually said, amongst an afflicted population. So you could live without affliction, even though you were in the midst of a population that was struggling with their emotions. And finally, and this just kind of puts it right on the head, is that you could dwell without stinginess. You know, of all the exalted terms that the Buddha, you know, he was so beautiful in terms of having clarity on language, and stinginess is a word that he used, you know, in all the different translations from all the different authors and everything. It's actually stinginess was the word that he chose, because it's kind of a special kind of attachment. You know, it's like, not only am I attached to it, but you aren't going to get me. You know, I'm holding on to this. So he said, you could dwell without stinginess amongst a population obsessed by the stain of stinginess. And I've always thought that language was significant. He doesn't just say you can dwell without stinginess among a population obsessed by stinginess, you know, which is kind of the model. He says by the stain of stinginess. you know, so that, you know, like a stain on your hand or on your arm, you know, it's it elevates the meaning. It's something because people can see if you're stingy. You know, it is a stain from a Buddhist perspective on the qualities of mind that you're trying to create. And sometimes it's a stain you can't remove. You know, so all right. So characteristics of generosity, and you know, everybody here has probably heard 50 talks on dana. Or many talks on dana. Okay, so this is basically about dana in the sense of service, and I've tried to look at some things here that may not sound so familiar, and that for me are important. So, the first thing is when generosity is actually present, not just when you're doing. You know, there's a difference between doing a generous act and there being generosity. There can be generosity and you don't do the act for one reason or another. It doesn't appear to be the right thing to do. It'd still be that whole sense of generosity. It'd still be embodied. So, you know, what is present? And basically two things. And the first thing the Buddha said was, there is an open hand. And I really love that, you know, because it's so symbolic. And in some of the standing Thai statues, you'll see them with an open hand. So it's this sign of dana or generosity. So, you know, there's no limitation on it, right? You know, it's a sign of brotherhood or sisterhood or family that, you know, any time, day or night, you will be treated with kindness and generosity. It's very much like metta in the sense that it's unconditional. That's the symbol of it, and that the generosity is freely given. You know, it's the reverse of the second precept. You know, I will not take anything that is not freely given. Well, the freely given part is the generosity part. Like, there's no strings on it, and so. You know, we had a discussion over the weekend with this group about giving, you know, and all kinds of, you know, giving to homeless people, what have you, and what happens. And one person reported that they had been quite generous, and then afterwards they didn't get the response they expected, and they were pretty upset about it, you know. So, I mean, that would be an illustration of something that's not freely given, because there's an expectation, you know. So from a Buddhist perspective, generosity is given without any strings attached. In the same way they say about metta and compassion, that it's like the sun, that it shines equally on everyone. You know, there's no strings attached to that. The ideal is the same with generosity. So the qualities that appear in the mind when generosity is really there, I really like these. And you may or may not have heard these, but I think you may not have. So the first one is that the mind that is filled with generosity and engages in a generous act delights in the relinquishment or letting go of whatever's being given. You know, that there's actually a pleasure, that it's nourishing. And I know this to be true because with the Sacramento Dharma Center, you know, there was so much confusion and controversy, and this group here, I think we needed a like a group psychiatrist. It was really schizophrenic, you know. We contributed money, we took it back, and we gave money again, and everybody's still confused about it and what have you. And I think we're hopefully past all of that. But I know that I went through a bunch of different periods of ambivalence. So at the very end, you know, they needed money. We really went to it and raised quite a bit of money. And I contributed what for me is a very large sum of money, and money that I just don't have to contribute, that kind of money. I just don't. And so I sat down to write the check. And I said to myself when I got the check, well, this is really going to be interesting. You know, I mean, like, what am I going to feel when I write this out, you know? So I sat down and I just, like, really looked at the check. You know? And then I wrote out, you know, Sacramento Dharma Center very slowly. And then I looked at it, you know, and then I wrote the amount of money, which I looked at a lot longer. And then I signed it, and I addressed an envelope, and I had such a pure feeling of doing exactly the right thing, the thing that needed to be done for the Dharma, that it was completely in the service of the Dharma. And all of the ideas about, you know, I don't have this kind of money, and, you know, all of this other kind of BS just disappeared. You know, I felt like a real sense of joy, and the letting go of that money, the relinquishing, the renunciation, it was just really a delightful thing, you know. So when you're really acting from a sense of true generosity, that's how it feels. And if it doesn't feel like that, it's a good indication that something else is happening, you know, that you have mixed or confused or ambivalent elements in the giving, which frequently happens. You know, we frequently have all kinds of, but if this experience of and I love the word delight, because that's exactly what it feels. It's like, wow, I mean, that just feels so sweet to do that, you know? So that's one. The second one is experiencing a delight in either giving or sharing. And if you look through the suttas, the discourses, the Buddha was very clear that it's not just about you know, like giving something to somebody and then stepping back, because a lot of people can't do that. They don't have something to give in that way. But they may have something to share, you know, that they could share a meal, or they could share their time, or they could share their effort, you know. So then you know, when you start to cultivate this, when you try to perfect it, you know, you have to be creative and come up with all kinds of practices to help you do this, you know. So, like, one for me, this, we just came back from our 10-day retreat, and the in a teaching role, you know, it's like, well, it's a silent retreat, right? And starting the third day, you know, in addition to giving some instruction, maybe giving a Dharma talk that night, you're conducting two group interview sessions a day, and you know, it's very demanding, and it's a whole practice of learning how to just fall into that and let go and not having any expectation other than doing that. And if you can do that, then it becomes energizing, you know, it's exciting. But you can have a rough day and be exhausted, okay? And it's usually one of those days, you know, where, like, you just say to yourself, boy, I mean, like, I'm beat, you know? And for those of you who haven't been on residential retreat, kind of the protocol is that if you want to meet with a teacher, you write a note on the board, you know, and it's like, hey, could I have a private interview with you or have a private meeting? So it's usually on a day when you're exhausted, okay? You're walking down the hall, And a yogi will come up to you and with all sincerity, you know, violate the rule about putting a note on the board. And they'll pull you off to the side and they'll say, "Can I talk to you? It'll only take a minute." And that second line, when they say, "It'll only take a minute," you know you're in for trouble. If they just say, "Can I talk to you?" it's like, okay, they just want to talk to you. But I don't know what it is. So now you know what not to say. Don't say it'll only take a minute. So, you know, you're always kind of looking for, when you're developing a generosity practice, you're looking like, well, where's your edge? You know, where do you stop feeling generous? You know, I'm a very generous person, you know, I say to myself, you know. I'm devoted to the Dharma. I try to give my time freely and everything. And honestly, at that moment, when I'm really tired, you know, all these things, I've got to give a Dharma talk that night, and somebody says, you know, it'll just take a minute, that's my edge. It's like, oh man, I don't think I can do it, you know. And sometimes it's very visceral. You know, it's like either you start to close down or you pull back or what have you. And but I know this. I mean, you can hear that I know this about myself. And so then that becomes my edge. Okay, so like in that moment, what do I do to restore myself and like open my heart and say yes? You know, sometimes, being entirely truthful, sometimes I say, I just can't do it right now. You know, so let's figure out a time later tonight or tomorrow morning. But most of the time when somebody approaches you like that, you know, they know they're supposed to put a note on the board. And so for me anyway, it tends to indicate a sense of urgency that something's up for somebody, frequently difficult and like, I need some help. I mean, that's the message, you know. So I try to respond to that as best I can. So, at the moment of them saying, it'll only take a minute, at that moment I'm probably not having delight in the giving and the sharing. But once I position myself properly and say yes and actually sit with somebody, one of the greatest delights is being able to help someone in the Dharma. You know, and the Buddha always said that, but when you actually have the opportunity to do that, I mean, actually be of help by sharing the Dharma, it really is a delight. So the next quality, the third one, and I think this is the thing that kind of separates the idea of I'm a layman interested in generosity and I'm a layman who's attempting to become a noble discipline, is that not only am I delighted in, you know, relinquishing something, not only am I delighted in giving or sharing, but I am actually devoted to being charitable. That has become a significant part of my life. It's something I can point to what that means. So it's not just kind of this generalized sense of, well, I'm trying to be generous and I'm trying to be kind. And is it like, no, in addition, there is a devotion or a vow or a commitment, a very, very deep intention to being charitable itself, and charitable in the sense of seeking out those who are less fortunate than we are and looking after them. And finally, and this is kind of implied in the things I've already said, but the fourth thing is that there's a renunciation, a letting go, or a giving up of stinginess. Okay. But I mean, once again, I mean, like, here it is again. He's talking about stinginess, you know. So it's actually a product of reflection. Like, I'm making a commitment to renounce stinginess. You know, I'm making a commitment to let go. Whatever, you know, different words help different people, but it's out of this huge tradition in Buddhism of restraint. So it starts with restraint, and then it moves into no, I'm going to actually renounce it or give it up. You know, at first I'm restraining my stinginess. I'm restraining the urge to be stingy. And then as that starts to being replaced with acts of generosity and then the beauty of the feeling of generosity starts to replace this urge for stinginess. And so the default starts to change. Does that work? Okay. Yeah, so that's what all these practices are about, is starting off someplace where maybe it's not so admirable, but it's just the way things are. You know, it's the nature of the mind. And then we very, very slowly, over time, start to train the mind in a different direction, point the mind in a different direction, and we now know that it's neurological. You know, if we really practice this stuff, that it actually changes neural pathways in the brain and our default changes. Okay, so the benefits of this, and then I'm going to talk about when should we be generous, which will probably be the most interesting part of the discussion. So the first one that you heard that the Buddha talked about, by being generous, it contributes to a very immediate presence, a sense of well-being in the world, because it feels good. You know, it feels good to be generous. And if it doesn't feel good, then there's something wrong. You know, then you have to examine. So it's very common in the East for teachers, people will come in and they say, you know, I want to be a student. And they'll assign one of two things. They'll assign, like, for a year, the practice of generosity. That's your practice. I'll work with you with generosity. I'm not going to work with you on the teachings. I'm not going to work with you on meditation. Or the precepts. And in both cases, the reason that's done is that the precepts, which are all about restraint, and generosity, which is about restraint of a certain tendency and replacing it with something that's more wholesome and bright. Once those start to work over a period of time, and if you're just focusing just on those, rather than focusing on those and trying to be a meditator and trying to understand dependent origination, you know, just focusing on that it tends to really stabilize and settle the mind and ground it in these very wholesome qualities, so that then when you turn to teaching basic meditation, the mind is fertile. The ground has been prepared for the planting of instruction. Okay? So on a long-term basis, the more diligently we work with generosity, it hooks us into and it strengthens related factors. Okay, so one would obviously be restraint, right? Another would be metta. Another would be compassion. Another would be sympathetic joy. So generosity just starts linking. They're different, but they have similarities. And if you're in a generous, if you truly do a generous act, there has to be metta there someplace, you know. And if you do a truly generous act to someone in need, there has to be some element of compassion there. And so it starts linking us in to all the other qualities of mind that we're trying to develop. And, you know, I always thought it was very powerful that the Buddha said that if others knew what he knew about the implications of sharing a meal with someone else in terms of its implications for developing your practice and having a long-term effect on yourself and other people, that you would not let a meal go by without sharing it with someone. You know, that's a pretty extraordinary statement. You can't think of too many statements where he said things like that. You know, where he focuses on a single thing like that, a single act. So, I have to admit that I didn't know this until recently, that you can actually use generosity in the sense of reflecting on true acts of generosity as a concentration practice. Not just to reflect on it and make you feel yourself feel good, or as an antidote to thinking stingy thoughts or thinking greedy thoughts. That, I mean, you can do that. You can, you know, shift the energy, reflect on a time when you were actually generous. This is something different. This is reflecting on a truly generous act that you did and using it as a concentration practice. Just holding that and coming back to it and coming back to it, coming back to it to the exclusion of all other thoughts. And so everything you've ever heard about jhana practice or concentration practice on all these stages, that you could actually use an act of generosity as that kind of concentration practice. So, and the reports are, because I have not done this, they say they're delightful, not surprisingly, because of the subject. Okay. And then the last one is that, and this kind of loops it all together, that if you actually reflect on the kinds of things we're talking about, well, when I'm generous, what qualities are present? You know, what qualities are not present? Are there benefits in the present moment? Does it feel like this is pointing my mind towards a more stable and lasting peace? If you do that kind of reflection, it actually generates insight, generates wisdom. So it's not just like a practice that can make you feel delighted or make you feel good or be an antidote. It can actually contribute to the development of wisdom. And then I'm just going to throw this in. This is, I'm doing this. I used to not do this, but I'm doing it now, I guess. In the same way that I'm not concerned with the fact that I'm losing my hair and that everybody knows about it now. you know, I really think that there are elements to this practice. We don't talk about it very much, but this practice, the key parts of it, particularly like insight, are all pre-verbal experiences. They're pre-cognitive experiences. Now, we have to take that and let it work in our system and then somehow use words and concepts to define what has happened. But if you really look at the body-based nature of this practice, the sensory-based nature of the practice, and the nature of insight itself, it's absolutely clear that it is not a cognitive process. And I didn't bring it tonight, but to defend myself against the skeptics when I raise this is, Upandita, you know, is one of the lions of for our tradition and for our Western teachers. He's very clear about this. He says that from kindergarten we have been raised to look for all of the answers to our problems and to define the problems through thinking. And he said that's very helpful, but that's only one way of solving problems, and it is not conducive for meditation. Meditation requires this process of looking directly into our experience and allowing spontaneous insight to arise on its own, not to try to think our way into the problem. So it's a balancing of these two great powers of the mind and the body. So at this point in my life, I take that really significantly, significant because I'm clear that so much of my reactions to things are not coming through my mind. That they're coming through urges and sensations and reactions and feelings in my body. And you know the difference. You know, a mystic comes back and writes in poetry, right? He has an experience. And why does he write in poetry? Because what he experienced, you can't. If you write it down rationally, you probably get a 51-50. You get committed, right? But there's whole pieces of the practice where the best you can do is describe the mechanism. And if you really think about it, so many of the results the Buddha never defined. And specifically, he never defined what nirvana, you know, liberation, awakening felt like or looked like. You know, there's the 33 names for awakening, and they're all like the unconditional. You know, all of these big spit, that didn't tell you anything. So what's waiting for us with this practice is much bigger than just our rational mind. Our rational mind compared to what's waiting for us, our rational mind is like this little shriveled up mind compared to the whole mind of the body and the human mind. So that leads to this idea of counterbalancing. And this guy from the Bay Area, his name is Mark Morford, who is Joanna Macy, the Buddhist scholar, is a big fan of his. He's kind of a younger guy, maybe in his late 30s, early 40s. He's a yoga teacher. And this is what he says on this principle. He said, realize that for every ongoing war and religious outrage and environmental devastation and military attack plan, there are 1,000 counterbalancing acts of staggering generosity and humanity and art and beauty happening all over the world right now on a breathtaking scale. And I believe that to be true. And you know, we hear about all the trash on the news, and anything that happens any place, we know it immediately, right? But all of the things that, I mean, has anybody heard recently on whatever website that you get? You know, I have Bing, you know, it's my driver, and they flash up this band, and it has, I don't know, like 20 top stories today with a picture, you know, and so every website you go to has something like this and what have you. Has anybody recently seen a story on the women who are caring for all the lepers and the sick people that Mother Teresa used to care for? Anybody seen that recently? Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, there's just no juice in it. Right? But you know, any crazy thing that's negative is going to be up on that bar. And whether we like it or not, it absolutely influences who we think we are and what kind of world we live in.
If a little six-year-old boy, food like that little six-year-old boy to come from Syria, and there were millions and millions of responses to it, it says a lot.
Yeah. I don't know, so I didn't actually see this, but I think maybe while we were on retreat, there somebody did a clip of this man. Maybe somebody knows about this and can talk about this man who was in his 80s and he's kind of humped over and he was out selling cigarettes.
No, he was selling popsicles.
Yeah, and so that thing just went viral, and I guess in a week or 10 days or something, you know, they raised like
$350,000.
Yeah, between $300,000 and $400,000, you know. And he said he really appreciated it, but he might continue going on selling popsicles because he likes to do it, you know. But you know, we don't see that stuff. And so, like in this how can I help course that everybody's involved in, part of it is that everybody has to do a certain number of hours of community service. Well, nobody's going to put that on the 6 o'clock news, or that's not going to get a bunch of special attention. And if from a Buddhist perspective, we don't need that. We're not looking for it either. But to realize, like he says, that there's thousands of counterbalancing acts going on all over the world, for me, is really helpful, because I always get hooked in on what's happening to kids all around the world. You know, and then if I'm not careful, that takes me down. So, when should we be generous? So I'm just going to throw out a couple of ideas, and then I'm going to open it to you guys. And the implication of all of this, you know, like, gee, the open hand and freely given and all of this, is that, well, there's no limitation. You know, that we should always be open-handed. We should always be generous. And there's a lot to say for that point of view, because frequently generosity is taught in the context of karma. You know, that in every act there's a consequence, you know. And in Buddhist teaching, you know, there are types of generosity that where you get more karmic points than other kinds. So I'm not even going to talk about that. You know, we can get enough striving without that. But I don't think that the Buddha said any place that we should always be giving. You know, that there is in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, one of the foundations is what's called clear comprehension. And clear comprehension basically is understanding the consequence of what you're doing. And so there are times where it either is or seems like it is inappropriate to give. And I don't think the Buddha would have, if you look all of his teachings about being a householder, it's very clear. He even talks about securing financial security for you and your family and your heirs. So it's very clear that giving outside of the scope of what is capable, for example, giving in a way that would destabilize your financial position, would not be consistent with his fundamental teachings. So, you know, it isn't just about being a wonderful person, it's also doing it in a reasoned way. And I think what people have been trying to focus on the course we're in is realizing that that's a moment-to-moment, situation-by-situation decision. There aren't too many hard rules other than don't destabilize your financial life, you know, a couple like that. But Ram Dass, who is one of the people whose books we're working with, and it's called How Can I Help by Ram Dass and Paul Gorman. And if you haven't read this book, I would encourage you to read it. I read it every year. Every single year, I read this over again. It's a fascinating book because it takes all of the Dharma principles that we're talking about and doesn't use much Dharma language. It has been written in a way to try to make this accessible. And then communicates through vignettes from people who are doing service, all different kinds of service. So it's a very nice book. But Ram Dass says about this, listen to this language. It takes the split second timing of a quiet mind. Okay, you know, normally we're thinking, you know, we're in meditation, we're a quiet mind, it's, you know, everything is slowed down. And, you know, here, so it takes the split second timing of a quiet mind working in harmony with an open heart to know just when and how to say yes. So, you can write a couple books on this, but there it is, right? That takes the split-second timing of the quiet mind working in harmony with the open heart to know just when and how to say yes. So, pretty beautiful summation. So, and then I'm just going to give a pitch and then open it to you. There's a brochure on the back of the table when you walked in. I was going to ask everybody to get one. And what this is the SIM board. You know, this looks like a pretty simple little brochure, okay? The amount of time that it took the SIM board to agree on this, put it together, define it, it's unbelievable, okay? But good, you know, because it created a lot of clarity. And what this is our effort to identify the vast majority of volunteer work that we need to keep this organization going. There are positions and then there's the amount of time that's estimated that it would take to do that. Okay? So it is my belief, whether the SIM board believes this is maybe another issue, but it's my belief that unless we are able to, you know how they say in football and basketball, they've got a deep bench, you know? That unless we get a deep bench on every single position in here, that we're going to have trouble as an organization surviving over the long haul. We don't have a deep bench now, and it's the reason that we just burn people up, which is what most nonprofits do. Small group of people, they'll come in, you know, they'll make a commitment for 7 or 8 years, you know, they just work really hard, and then that's it, they're burnt out, and then they leave, and maybe they're still around, but they're not contributing from a volunteer perspective. So that's what we're doing to people. We can start naming them off, people we've burned up. So I think there's something anti-Buddhist about this. but very, very typically not for profit. So we've tried to make this like really approachable. So like you can do just like a little bit of work every month, or just agree that if somebody in front of you couldn't do it, that you'd be willing to step up and do it. Okay. So I would really encourage you all to take a look at this and that urge, you know, like when somebody comes up and says, you know, I need to talk to you, only take a minute. Okay. Treat this brochure that way. I don't think I even want to look at that brochure. Okay. So maybe this is an edge to look at and say, wow, maybe I should consider this. Because we're moving into this new center. It's going to take more manpower to do this. I mean, like, I just got trained on how to close the center, okay? We have two doors, a door here, a door there, okay? This center is 8,700 square feet with 6 separate entries, all of which have to be checked before you can leave, you know? So just kind of getting the model down and making it work is a lot of effort. And there are a lot of exciting things that we could do. You know, there's a lot of special projects we could do to serve the community more. I mean, I know people love working at St. John's Kitchen. And I love those kinds of projects. And we could come up with a bunch more. And there's several suggestions for that. If we don't do this, there won't be those other projects. You know? So for me, this is all these little jobs, which seem like they're nothing at all, actually are a lot of the Dharma. And so I can feel like if I go too much further, I'm going to start getting heavy-handed, so or pleading or weeping or something. So okay, so we've got a few minutes here, 10 or 15 minutes to talk. So Thoughts, comments about the whole generosity issue, what you may have been doing or trying to do. And for those of you who are in the How Can I Help course, if there's some comment that you'd like to make, that would be nice.
I just see all these wonderful things to do, and I don't know who to contact. I would like to be a name badge yogi sometimes, and I'd like to be a tea yogi, and all these nice things, but I don't know who to contact and how to make sure that comes to pass.
Okay, I think there should be right in the start here.
Does it say something?
Yeah. I haven't looked at this in a while, but I know right up front there are
check www.zactoinsight to get up and up. Today, list of volunteer opportunities.
Let's see here.
Is it
a site
that has
made
contact?
Did
the names get vetoed?
No, I don't. I just vetoed some more of it.
Any of the things on that brochure, there's a couple key people, right? There's any one of the board members you could talk to, and we can get you hooked up with any type of the yogi type jobs. So we have Barbara here, me, Brian, Dennis, any one of us. Can
we have directories, or it's just...
On the SIM website, there is, Renee at ZactoInsight.com,
yeah,
Brian at ZactoInsight.com.
So the board members,
right now, the board members are going to be the liaisons to any of the board or the board jobs and stuff.
Okie dokie.
Yeah. And we're in the infancy of this, right? And we've got some people doing reading. We have the setup people doing that regularly.
And so we may be in the infancy of proofreading our brochure, even though it's been proofread like 80 times.
It is over proofread.
I'm bound and determined to find that in here. I'm not having much luck right now. So, okay. Yeah, Brian.
When you were talking about the billboard on the retreat, I may be one of those that bypassed the billboard. And I always felt like you always...
The billboard?
Well, the bulletin board.
Yeah.
I don't think I ever used that, sorry. But, for me, when I would go to you and I was struggling, you always took the time for me, and I always appreciate that on almost every, I think every retreat I've gone on, I've utilized that service. But it's huge for me that you've always done that for me, whether sitting down in the garden or walking that mile and a half or whatever down to the road, any of your knees. And on the How Can I Help Us, I started working with my mom on her medical issues, and to sit with her and to have her like almost incapacitated, which I've never experienced in my life. She's always going 100 miles an hour, never sits. And to see her sleep for all day and, for a week or 10 days straight was pretty difficult. And so in that class, what I did is learn how to open up to that and to have compassion for her and what she's going through. And then also the part where Joanne Macy talked about not getting yourself burnt out.
Yeah, let me just comment on this, okay? Because, you would think that our natural instinct would be to open. And, like that story, like so many of us have family of origin issues where we've closed down, And so we're actually having to either learn or relearn through these practices how to open up and be there.
Yeah, for me, mine was just totally closed down. Like, if I don't acknowledge it, it doesn't exist. Mom will survive without me. And so when she had this huge hematoma issue, and to like see her suffering and to like want to massage her leg and to try and relieve some of the suffering, that was huge for me. And then to work with my sister-in-law who's had multiple strokes, you know, and to be with her through, I think you'd caution us about doing things for people rather than helping them, taking away their independence. That was a huge lesson for me too, is to help rather than do. So I took away, or I haven't taken away a lot from that. And it's really, and then the retreat on the Brahma Viharas and bringing in a whole package has been a huge 6 months for me, for opening and
yeah, that's great, Brian. Yeah. You know, I was reading the sutta this afternoon on, it's basically a sutta on service to your parents.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, basically the message is no matter what's happened, that a human birth is so precious that whoever gave you that deserves this this great level of generosity. And one of the things that he specifically mentions is about washing and massaging your mother and your father if they're sick. So there it is, right?
It's a huge there. Experience.
Yeah,
it's like,
you know.
Yeah, it's incredible. Watch the mind, how one part wants to... I found myself clamping down so much I was actually hurting her. And to watch that, oh shit, you know, like lighten up a little bit and to back up and at one point just releasing the massage because I was like getting all knotted up physically.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, it's been huge for me, so thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
I think sometimes an impediment to this kind of generosity is that it's anticipatory burnout. That you think you may not, in fact, you know you're already busy, you know this is too much, and you think you will not be able to protect yourself from that burnout. And so I often have found that it's really important for me to self-define what my edge is. Mm-hmm. And then within that, I can give quite freely and end up giving more. But every time someone looks at one of these lists and goes, that's me in it, you know, that's, if you can find the one thing you can do, even if it's only 10 minutes a month, and then expand from there, but to really honor your own boundaries, because otherwise you will not be giving generous, you will not be giving freely.
Yeah, thank that. I mean, that's really well said, and you'll notice in there that, as per your suggestion, we tried to actually put a time estimate on what each one of those little tasks are. You know, so some of them are 15 or 20 minutes, and some of them are a couple of hours, you know, a month. So, but thank you.
And I'm speaking as a setup volunteer, and sometimes you think, oh no, it can't have come up this fast again. but when you start doing it, when you start laying out the room, it feels so good to be preparing the hall for everyone to come. Once you start doing it, it feels good.
Yeah.
One thing that seems to work for people is if instead of request being made for this allotment, this duty for the year or something, small time periods, so that you're not feeling you're going to be obligated no matter what, you know, for a long time, you're like, what am I going to do? I have to quit. You're going to be like, not, you know, and so it's broken up. Request is broken up.
Yes. I agree completely, and that's, I think, kind of links with what Margaret said is, you know, well, what is it that would work for you? You know, and if you're willing to commit for like 2 months to do something, or 3 months, or a half a year, whatever it is, then, you know, us being flexible enough to try to create things that actually work for people, you know, in the end, right? I mean, that's what practice is all about, right? Is figuring out how to be flexible and adaptable enough to make something work, and that's what we hopefully are trying to do as an organization. So, thank you.
Okay. Yeah, for those of you that don't know, I'm the setup coordinator, and we're the 14 years, I've made lots of appeals to the whole group here, and not always a lot of answers. There are volunteers. But when you go to a person directly and ask them, sometimes it works a lot better. I mean, people are different, but I've found that I get more responses that way than making a general announcement.
Yeah. So, in light of that, what I'd like everyone to do is turn to the person next to you and say, I'm asking you to make a commitment. So. Okay. Okay, attention, Jerry.
So I have a comment. Just I'm in the class and reading the books as best I can, and just in light of the talk tonight, which kind of frames generosity for us in terms of the suttas and everything. It's just been very helpful to actually read a book about generosity that's somewhat accessible. It's not as much as Dennis says it is, but it's somewhat accessible. And be in the class with the other folks. Probably all of us in this group do some charity work or giving work or something on an occasional basis or something. And when you're in that kind of a group, and you hear the totality of what people are doing, and some people are doing tremendous amounts of work, and some of us are doing little tiny bits of work, you know. But it's huge, you know, and it's really helped me think about, well, what does generosity or helping work mean? You know, so I guess maybe I've gotten a little intellectual about it and everything, but I've certainly got a much better framework of what it means to be kind of focused on doing that kind of work rather than just kind of doing the fun stuff in my life, you know, the stuff that I want to do for myself because it makes me feel good, you know. And I'm kind of acknowledging Dennis for doing this. It's a year-long course, and we're still in the middle of it. Having the opportunity to actually study the chapters in the book and the vignettes in the Ram Dass book, and compare them with what you're doing and what you're feeling, and then try and analyze what you're doing. You know, well, not analyze so much, but just experience, understand your experience. It makes a huge difference in doing that, and I really got a better feeling for how, you know, we've always heard about people in the East who were born Buddhist and Buddhist families and stuff. Well, they start out with generosity. This is what they do all the time. This is their practice. And I think we start out with meditation, and we generally start out in middle age doing that. but you can just see how that could influence a whole culture. A whole society, you know, and you can and so I don't know where that goes, to be honest, but it feels a lot different since we've been kind of working with it. So I'm actually quite appreciative of it, and it's really worthwhile to kind of look into, yeah. Well, what is your generosity, you know? And about stinginess, so I'll just personally speaking, it's like, yeah. Trying to look into my stinginess factor, which is pretty high up there. You know, how much money do I have, and should I give, and all of that. You know, so that's a reflection that it's worthwhile. It's worthwhile to think about, and kind of get over.
You know. Thanks, Drew. Okay, one more.
I'm in that class too, and I came into it thinking, how can I help? I'm going to help. I'm going to go somewhere and I'm going to be helping everybody. I'm going to be doing something really good. And by the time I hear what you have to say tonight, and this transformation has been taking place during the year, how's it going to help me? What is it doing for me? It's really not an experience for the other person at all. It happens, maybe. It's be beneficial to somebody else. But it's about how the service changes me and helps me and makes me happy and delighted, rather than what am I going to go in there and help somebody?
Yep.
It's complete. It's turned around completely for me.
Yeah. And if you're coming from that place, then the other person completely feels it. That's why it's reciprocal, you know. Because if like I told that story about working with the homeless women, and they said, you know, we're just sick of people trying to help us. You know, we just want somebody to treat us like a human being, and that I need something, and you just want to support me, you know. And so if we're coming from that place and actually getting kind of this pretty pure joy in terms of actually helping somebody, then they feel that, and it's nourishing for them, and it's nourishing for us.
I just want to say one thing. I'm not part of the group, but I've been involved in volunteering for SAMHSA in a lot of different arenas, and I think one of the most important things is how it builds community. When you volunteer, you get to know each other in a way that you don't know when you just come to a sit and listen to a talk. But when you work together, you begin to develop friendships and community that builds an organization that is every bit as strong as the need to volunteer. And so, I really encourage everybody to think about being a part of SAM and being a part of the group by doing something.
Just
to
enrich your experience.
One
just
more.
1 minute.
Quickly. No.
20 seconds. Has there ever been a suggestion of having a sign up there? You know, you have these, whatever the papers are. You sign up, and it's only maybe for 3 months, and we have 4 signed there, 7 signed there, 2 signed there, 12 signed there, and we have, it feels kind of durable, substantial, we've got something going. There might be one person who's sort of the head, you know, the point person.
Maybe next week.
Maybe a week. How many times a year we can have a quarterly, yeah. That we have a sign up there.
Yeah, good idea. Okay, so I want to say one thing before everybody goes. Barbara, remind me to put this in the e-news as well, okay? But what we're going to try to do next Thursday is get as many people here as possible, and particularly, you know, like all of our core people and a lot of our volunteers, and do a big group photo, okay? Because over at the Dharma Center, what I think each group is going to do is have a picture of their current sangha. You know, we each can have our own office. Think about that. Wow. So if you can make it next Thursday night, please do. And our photographer extraordinaire Renee is going to bring her equipment, and we're going to take a picture. Okay.
In her drummy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So thank you very much for coming, and may all of us and all beings everywhere be free from suffering. Okay, thank you.